Welcome to the July 2015 issue of Dialogues in Dermatology. The American Academy of Dermatology is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This activity is certified for 2 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. The date of original release for this issue is July 2015. The expiration date is June 2018. At the conclusion of this learning activity, participants should be able to recognize risks, benefits, and dosing recommendations in the treatment of acne, identify the National Institute of Health diagnostic criteria for neurofibromatosis 1, and recognize recent advances in the diagnosis and management of vitiligo.
Welcome back to Dialogues in Dermatology. This is Terry Cronin, your editor-in-chief. This is Dialogues in Dermatology for July 2015, Volume 71, Issue 7. I hope you're having a wonderful summer and protecting yourself from the sun. Remember to download the fabulous new Dialogues in Dermatology app for your smartphone and computer. This convenient app is making dialogues even more accessible and enjoyable while effectively providing CMEs for you. In this month's edition, we have three dialogues focusing on acne, neurofibromatosis, and vitiligo. The advent of isotretinoin has revolutionized the way we treat and think of acne. Though not without adverse effects, isotretinoin is the most effective treatment for severe cystic acne. In this dialogue, Dr. Julie Harper and Dr. Linda S. Calls candidly discuss their evidence-based practices and experience with isotretinoin, including dosing regimens, side effects, and managing contraception in women on this often controversial medicine.
Hello, this is Linda Calls, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Julie Harper about acne treatment controversies. Julie is a clinical associate professor at the University of Alabama in Birmingham, and she also practices in Birmingham. So the first topic I'd like to discuss is dosing in isotretinoin. We've had articles recently that have showed a lower relapse rate with higher doses, and also articles showing that a lower dose is much more tolerable and patients enjoy a lower dose. So maybe you can just sort of let us know what we should know and what you find yourself doing.
I think everything you just said there, Linda, is absolutely true. And so much of this, we don't have a hard and fast recipe that's going to be exactly right for every single person. There's evidence out there, and it's based on retrospectively looking at numbers. People who have lower remission rates did in general seem to get a little bit higher dose. And that's where those kind of magical numbers came from recently. I think so many people now have started to dose their isotretinoin, not necessarily based on what the dose should be per day, but trying to achieve those cumulative doses of 120 to 150 milligrams per kilogram total dose. And how you get there may not matter. You may be able to achieve those doses by doing a low dose daily and stretching that treatment out over a period of time, or you can do the more traditional, pretty quickly getting to 1 mg/kg per day and getting there in 16 to 20 weeks. But it does appear that if you short that dose very much, you're going to have a higher chance of a relapse rate. And one of the most beautiful things about this drug is not how well it works while you're on it. It's that long-term remission that you can stand to get. Now, there's also, though, that group of people who, and I would say in general, and some of this is based on my experience and not based on hard and fast evidence in the literature, but we have those people who take full courses of isotretinoin and they do well, but every time they stop, the acne recurs. And those people, I can tell you from giving many lectures and hearing anecdotal reports, those are people that do well on low-dose long-term treatment. The hard part about that is our pregnancy prevention program, iPledge. It's very difficult to do that in a female of childbearing potential. In fact, it's almost impossible to do that and follow all the rules of iPledge. But we do have dosing options with this drug. At the very base of this too, you know, what we've learned lately, and actually we've known it forever, but with some of the new products that are out there, it's reminded us all, it's important how you take this drug too. So dosing is important, but also reminding our patients that they must take this with food, and not just with food, but with high fat food. And that's a little bit of a hard thing to look at a young patient and say, you need to be sure you're eating enough fat when you take this drug, but we do think it works better like that.
Do you have any certain foods that you recommend that patients take it with? I've heard peanut butter is popular.
Well, you know what? I have mentioned peanut butter too, because at least that is a good fat. It's not full of some of the worst fats that are out there. And it came up today in one of our sessions at the Academy that peanut butter might be a good choice, but that's anecdotal. We have absolutely no evidence to support that peanut butter would do the job as effectively as a hamburger, or better or worse. We just don't know.
Do you divide the dose or do single dosing?
It's very interesting that you say that. If you look at the evidence, I think the evidence would support dividing the dose, and yet I do single day dosing. I find the compliance better, and to me, you know what, I've never had a problem. I've been in practice for many years. I've never seen this product not work. So you have to separate sometimes. Yes, maybe the pharmacokinetics of the drug look prettier if you give it twice a day, but does that translate into a different outcome? And I'm not so sure that it does. So if you've got a patient who's going to do better taking something once a day, I think once a day seems to work just as well as twice a day.
Help us with some of the side effects that we're seeing with isotretinoin, like pseudotumor cerebri and the bowel disease.
I think there is so much misinformation out there, and unfortunately some of it is misinformation amongst us as specialists, but a whole lot of it is with our patients. So we'll see people come to clinic and they've got this horrendous scarring acne, and yet they're scared to death to take this drug because of something they've read online that's not substantiated. I had an interesting case within the last year of a young woman who came in. She was actually an adult woman, 28. She had very severe acne, scarring acne, and she was tearful and distressed, and you could just tell really burdened by the amount of acne that she had. And she told me, I have seen 6 dermatologists, and no one will give me isotretinoin because 10 years ago, I had pseudotumor cerebri to doxycycline. Can you help me? It's a little bit scary even as the physician who writes a whole lot of isotretinoin. We don't have and we won't have controlled clinical trials that look at the risk of pseudotumor cerebri with isotretinoin. So what do you do with a case like that? Well, we're left balancing risk and benefits. So here I've got this person who has on her face scars. So that risk is pretty clear cut. What's the risk of pseudotumor cerebri? And this case forced me to go to the literature and see what I could find. There was a case report in Ophthalmology in 2004. It was actually a case series where the authors went to the spontaneous reporting systems. There were 3 of them. One was through the FDA, one was through the World Health Organization, and one was through an ophthalmology organization. And they found 179 cases of isotretinoin and pseudotumor cerebri. And out of those cases, about 24% of the people had also been on a tetracycline either right before or simultaneously with the drug. Probably the most compelling piece of this was that there were 6 of those cases that stopped the medicine, they got better, but then they were rechallenged and the pseudotumor came back. So there's no doubt, there's a pretty strong link that yes, isotretinoin can cause pseudotumor cerebri, but we don't know who that's going to happen to. Does having a prior incidence of this with doxycycline make it any more likely? The answer is probably no. So it's best, I think the best that I could say is know what to look for. Tell your patients to watch for that new headache that's different, that's associated with vision changes. Do they have any very temporary loss of vision even? Is their physiologic blind spot getting larger? Is their headache associated with double vision or any kind of blurring vision or nausea or vomiting or photosensitivity, somewhat like a migraine? Those should be enough, at least in the presence of this drug, to make us get that referral, get ophthalmology involved, get neurology involved, get someone involved who can evaluate for papilledema and for pseudotumor cerebri, because the real message is we just need to diagnose it early.
I think there's some safety that I feel seeing patients on isotretinoin, knowing that I will see them every month. I hesitate more giving a prescription for minocycline if it's a several month follow-up, not knowing what side effects they're getting. One of the benefits for me with prescribing isotretinoin is knowing that I can check in on them every month.
I love the fact that we have these 30-day built-in review sessions where we can talk about any risk. You also mentioned minocycline. We can't talk about pseudotumor cerebri and isolate it to isotretinoin. It's been reported with minocycline, tetracycline, doxycycline, trimethoprim sulfa, corticosteroids, so many drugs that we use in dermatology, not just isotretinoin.
Update me on the bowel disease sort of what have we discovered?
I think, again, in so many ways, isotretinoin seems to be this lightning rod drug. So inflammatory bowel disease is another one. The drug, remember, was FDA approved in 1982. First case report was in 1986. And it was not ulcerative colitis or Crohn's, it was colitis, but it was a colitis that got better when the drug was stopped, and then when the person was rechallenged, the symptoms came back. So it was a fair amount of evidence that maybe the colitis was somehow associated with that isotretinoin. Fast forward several years, and we've seen several large epidemiologic studies. There was a study out by Bernstein from Manitoba that was a large study that looked at this and found no association with inflammatory bowel disease. But there was a problem with that study, and the main problem was they did not take into account the time lag between isotretinoin and the diagnosis of inflammatory bowel disease. So I think the average time lag was years. And so anytime you start spreading that time out, that biases the result toward the negative. The follow-up study to that was the Crockett study, and that's the study that got everybody's attention because it did show an association of ulcerative colitis with isotretinoin use. But that study did not control for prior antibiotic use. So these were still very good studies. I'm not being critical, but they weren't perfect epidemiologic studies. Then Margolis came out with a study that said, wait a minute, we need to really look at prior antibiotic use because doxycycline, in this case, is associated with Crohn's disease. The two most recent studies, though, one is by Alhousian, and it was a study that was a very large study that used the British Columbia residents aged 12 to 29, all of those residents in the province, as the reference group. And from that large study, I can tell you that they found no association at all with isotretinoin and inflammatory bowel disease. It's interesting, they looked at isotretinoin users, but they also separately looked at individuals on topical acne medications. And guess what? Yes, they found an association of topical acne medication and isotretinoin. So again, maybe the missing link here is that maybe acne itself is what's linked to inflammatory bowel disease. And I think we don't know the answer. There is a final study now, and I'm sure there will be more to come. I hate to use the word final, but there's a study out by Etmanen that was a nested case control study that controlled both for prior acne and prior antibiotic use. And it also found no association. So it seems like the trend in the data that we've seen as the studies have gotten better and each one tries to improve on the last study, that what we're seeing is really no association with inflammatory bowel disease.
I know depression has always been one that I find frustrating and that the data has almost shown the opposite if you look at mood surveys. But I think that almost all practitioners that have been prescribing isotretinoin have had isolated cases or situations where they feel that there may have been a mood change. I know there's a lot of underlying risks of depression and acne. What can we tell our patients?
Again, I agree with everything you said. Depression, I've seen it in individuals on isotretinoin. It's difficult to say whether it's really a cause and effect or if it's just an overlap because of that patient population that we're seeing. But it's way up there on my list of things that I'm going to counsel the patient about. I do give it to individuals who have a diagnosis of depression. And in fact, kind of back to what you and I said earlier, the fact that I'm going to get to monitor that person every 30 days is a comfort to me. And in many ways, the person who's already diagnosed with depression and who's being treated for depression and is already being monitored by a mental health professional, I feel really confident treating in concert with that mental health professional, treating that person. So I think it's one that certainly deserves mention. I think it happens in a minority of individuals who take the drug. Although it's not based on any study that I've seen, we clinically see people whose depression seems to improve while they're on the drug. And I should back up and say there was, Lee Zane did a nice review article several years ago that looked at that. And you're right that any of the studies, I think all of the studies that used an objective measure of depression showed that the depression actually got better while individuals were on isotretinoin. But it's still something that we have to talk about with our patients.
I think it's interesting, any mental health provider that's following a patient, if I've asked about starting isotretinoin, I've not had them hesitate to say, that's fine, I'll keep a close eye on them. It doesn't seem that it's worrying the psychiatrists with this medication or that they've seen a lot of bad results from isotretinoin.
I agree, and what a shame it would be if a person who had depression was not able to have their acne treated because of that. So I think that's our healthcare system at its best when two different providers are working together to make sure that a patient gets an outcome that they really need.
I know in my practice I see patients where I'm often considering a second course of isotretinoin where they've been on high doses of isotretinoin and haven't improved, and I'm thinking about increasing the dose. I do worry and don't really have a great understanding about the growth plates. How do we monitor those? When do we start to think about it and how do we follow that?
Well, I don't think any of us have a real clear picture about the growth plates and isotretinoin. There's plausibility here because there are older studies that are rat studies that look at vitamin A in rats. And we know that as the rat is given higher and higher and higher doses of vitamin A, the growth plates close. And so that's the plausibility that a retinoid would do the same thing. If you go to the literature and look for case reports, though, what you find, and I guess it is similar to that, you find case reports of that happening in individuals given super high doses for long periods of time. And so those are individuals who have disorders of keratinization. For example, epidermolytic hyperkeratosis. And these are people given, you know, 4 to 5 mg/kg per day for years at a time. And there are case reports there of premature closure of the epiphyses. I did find one report in the literature recently of perhaps isotretinoin being associated with premature closure of the epiphyses. But the individual also was a soccer player involved in sports, and we should keep in mind that sports and sports injuries are also a risk factor for premature closure of the growth plates. But I could only find one case report that looked at that, and I don't think even in that case can we say that it was certainly caused from isotretinoin.
I often see patients that are avid athletes complain of bone pain, especially young men, I find, complain of bone pain or back pain on isotretinoin. What do you do with those patients?
Well, you bring up some good points there, too. There are other bony changes that can happen with the retinoids, and one of those is hyperostosis, or that dish-like syndrome. But there's also just kind of this achiness that we'll see with the drug. And for the most part, I tell my patients, if this is something that you can manage with an NSAID, then I'm feeling pretty good about it. If it's not escalating, if it's not limiting your activity, we're going to press on with that. And I have not seen that be something that continues after the medication is discontinued.
If you would see bone pain persist after the course of isotretinoin, is that when you would look for hyperostosis?
It is. And in fact, I've done that. I have certainly sent people have radiographs if there's some really persistent pain that doesn't go away. To date, though, my findings have been negative, but I'm dealing with a young population, a young, healthy population, so I have not seen that be a big problem. It is interesting to me, though, when we talk about some of these bony changes, again, people are very quick to blame isotretinoin, and not often is that same person very quick to say, you know what, my son or daughter needs to quit playing soccer. We don't hear that, and yet we're very quick to say this must be isotretinoin. Do we need to stop the drug?
Having experienced the changes of isotretinoin from first putting a sticker onto the prescription to the very cumbersome iPledge system that we're using today, have we prevented pregnancy?
No, we have not. And in short, and it doesn't appear, and there are some studies that have looked at the data 2 years before iPledge when it was still part of the SMART program and 2 years after, and there's not a change in pregnancy. It appears that about every year we have between 125 and 150 fetal exposures while on isotretinoin. And that is still too many, but I'm not sure we're going to be able to completely prevent this. Out of those pregnancies, the vast majority are women who are saying that they're using oral contraceptives and condoms. So while we might be worried about that population who says they're abstinent, out of that number of pregnancies, only about 12 to 14% are from that population of women who say they're abstinent.
And my understanding is that it was more frequent in older women.
You're correct. The age range was 20 to 29 is where the bulk of this happened. There were a few down in the lower age group and a few in the higher, but the bulk was right there in the 20 to 29 age group.
Do we know when these pregnancies are happening? Are they happening at the end of the course or at the beginning? Is there something that we are missing when we're monitoring these patients?
Well, I think that's one thing that maybe we have gotten better at. So there was a time period where there were women who were pregnant when they started the drug, and we're not really seeing that much now. We are seeing exposures, though, during the treatment period, and there have been some, too, in that one-month period after treatment. And it stands to reason there was another interesting publication recently that looked at how compliant are women with what they tell us they're going to do with iPledge. So women were allowed, there were, I think, 80 women who were invited to fill out an anonymous survey. And there were going to be no repercussions about how they answered, but the survey was all about, if you put that you're abstinent, have you really been abstinent? If you put that you're taking an oral contraceptive, have you missed any pills? If you've put down that you're doing oral contraceptives and condoms, have you ever just used one form? Have you had unprotected sex during this time? And really the findings were, they were probably about what we would expect, fairly astounding that many, many people miss one pill. Many, many people who say they're going to use oral contraceptives and condoms don't use the condoms. out of the women who said they were going to be abstinent, a good portion of them were not abstinent. There was one signal in that group that the group of women who had been sexually active prior to and then wanted to be listed as abstinent, that was the group of women who then were sexually active. So, you know, when you're looking at patients in clinic and trying to decide, is this a person that I feel comfortable? And that's a hard position for us to be in. Do I feel comfortable letting this person say abstinence and none? The person who's been in a relationship and they're just not currently in one is probably a risky person to put abstinence and none on, to be perfectly frank. Now, the person who is abstinent, they have been abstinent, there's some evidence out there that that's not the person that we have to worry about.
I think another interesting controversy that we've seen in the past few years is the use of oral contraceptives and acne and the risk of clotting. How do we counsel patients about this risk and how do we choose the right oral contraceptive?
Well, this is a perfect segue from isotretinoin, where we have to do so much counseling about contraception. Combination oral contraceptive pills carry with them a certain amount of risk. And you got to put it into perspective. So I'm going to put some numbers out here because I think they help to tell the story. So a woman of childbearing potential who's not on a birth control pill has a baseline risk of having a venous thromboembolic event like a DVT. Her baseline risk is about 3 per 10,000 woman years. So 10,000 women for 1 year, they have a baseline risk of 3 clots. You take a birth control pill and that risk is doubled. Now, if you just say that phrase, that sounds scary, right? Birth control pill doubles my risk of having a VTE. But then you've got to put it into perspective. So it goes from 3 per 10,000 woman years to 6 per 10,000 woman years. Some of the newer progestin products, so the drospirenones of the world, have been linked now to maybe even a higher risk of VTE. Now we may be talking about tripled risk, so going from 3 to 6 to now 9 per 10,000 woman years. But still, albeit, we have to sometimes separate out what is a statistically significant risk and what is a real meaningful absolute risk in our clinic. I'm not sure going from 6 to 10 is a real meaningful jump. Now, how this has changed my thinking a little bit, though, remember that all of the, there are 4 oral contraceptives now that are FDA approved to treat acne, and I have to call trade names because we don't want to say the long, long hormonal names, but there are Estrastep, Ortho-tricycline, Yaz, and B-Yaz. And all of those indications read, these are FDA approved for acne in women who also desire contraception. And they are indicated like that because the risk of having a blood clot if you're pregnant is now close to 12 per 10,000 around the time of delivery, 20 to 30 per 10,000. So when you're using these drugs in a woman who also needs contraception, you are going to win no matter which one you pick, okay? Because you're preventing a higher risk, which would be the risk of pregnancy. But if maybe we're dealing with a younger woman and she's got tough acne and she doesn't want to do isotretinoin, her periods have started and they're pretty regular and you feel like you could do an oral contraceptive, now I think we have to balance the risk of that VTE or venous thromboembolic event against the risk in acne. And now it's just not as clear cut a win. So I think in a woman who needs contraception, this is a very easy decision. But in that younger age group, maybe where they don't need contraception, you should pause and you should think about the risk and you should have a real meaningful discussion with that young woman and her parents.
Do you think there's any differences in the efficacy of treating acne with the different oral contraceptives?
My personal opinion is that yes, there is. But a recent Cochrane meta-analysis, again from 2012, that compares all of the pills does not find a striking difference. Granted, while the Cochrane meta-analysis is very well done, there are limitations because all of these studies that they're comparing are not done in the same way. And so it's really difficult to get a meaningful answer. But in my clinical practice, I do. I think those that contain the more anti-androgenic progestins, like the drospirenone product, do give a more meaningful effect.
I've also had success adding a very low dose of spironolactone in patients that have been on oral contraceptives.
Agreed. And we've got good data to support that it's safe to add those together, keeping in mind that the drospirenone that's in the oral contraceptives available in the U.S. is equivalent to about 25 milligrams of spironolactone. So you should keep that in mind when you're adding spironolactone to it. But there's a published case series that looks at using those in combination.
Well, thank you very much. I've learned a lot, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Linda.
Retrospective studies demonstrate a cumulative dose of isotretinoin of 120 to 150 milligrams per kilogram results in longer remission rates. Patients who do not get that amount may have a higher chance of relapse. In comparison to twice-a-day dosing, daily dosing does not appear to affect remission rates, possibly because it encourages compliance. Finally, an aspect that may not be emphasized is the need to take the medication with high-fat foods to encourage absorption. Anecdotally, Dr. Harper likes to recommend taking isotretinoin with peanut butter. There are proven and controversial adverse effects of isotretinoin. With regards to pseudotumor cerebri, in a retrospective observational case series in 2004, Fraunfelder and colleagues found 179 reported cases of pseudotumor cerebri associated with isotretinoin use. There were 6 cases with positive rechallenge. The mean time from drug exposure to diagnosis was 2.4 months. Some pertinent questions to ask during monthly assessments include headache, double vision, transient obscurations of vision, and pulsatile tinnitus. Controversial adverse events associated with isotretinoin include inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD, mood changes, and bone effects. In a large case control study using the U.S. Insurance Claims Database, researchers found only ulcerative colitis was associated with previous isotretinoin exposure. The risk of developing ulcerative colitis was associated with increased doses and duration of isotretinoin. The absolute risk was minimal. However, a population-based case-control study using data from a Canadian epidemiology database could not demonstrate an association between inflammatory bowel disease. There are many confounding variables that make the association questionable, including the presentation of IBD and acne at similar ages, the possibility of acne associated with IBD, and the history of antibiotic use in IBD. Despite the lack of definitive evidence on the causal relationship of isotretinoin, the FDA added IBD as a possible adverse effect on isotretinoin's package insert. Mood changes have also been associated with isotretinoin use, although no definitive evidence has been demonstrated. The majority of patients receiving isotretinoin for acne are in their adolescence, which has been regarded as a time of heightened emotional reactions and turbulence. In a review of all the reported psychiatric adverse events reported in 5 million patients on isotretinoin, 24 cases of depression, 4 suicides, and 3 attempted suicides from isotretinoin overdose were found. Studies have actually found an improvement of quality of life when acne improved and a reduction in depressive symptoms and suicidal ideation. However, it is vital to question patients on mood changes before and during isotretinoin therapy. Bone homeostasis with isotretinoin exposure is complicated. In chronic long-term use and keratinization diseases, it has been shown to influence bone mineral density. Diffuse idiopathic skeletal hyperostosis syndrome, ossification of ligaments, particularly the spine, have been reported with long-term isotretinoin use. However, a recent study did not find any clinical radiographic abnormalities in acne patients who received long-term and/or multiple courses of isotretinoin. There have been no studies that demonstrate clinically significant risk of bone changes due to short-term isotretinoin therapy. However, as Dr. Harper points out, there is a risk of premature closure of growth plates with sports and sports injuries. Proper counseling is essential in isotretinoin. It is a teratogen and can cause major fetal abnormalities with exposure. The FDA-mandated iPledge program stipulates any female of childbearing potential must use 2 forms of highly effective contraception. Despite this labor-intensive program instituted in 2006, it has not decreased the number of fetal exposures per year. It appears that the concerning group of women are aged 20 to 29 and are sexually active or have been sexually active. The FDA approved 4 combined oral contraceptives, or COCs, for acne treatment: orthotricycline, Estrostep, YAZ, and BYAZ. All of them contain ethinyl estradiol in combination with different progestins. A recent review on COCs in acne demonstrated that in comparison to placebo, the number of acne lesions are reduced, but which specific COCs was superior was inconclusive. The association of venous thromboembolism and COCs is known with an estrogen dose-dependent relationship. While the estrogen component of COCs is typically the causative factor in the development of venous thromboembolism, there are potential additive effects with new generation progestins such as drospirenone. However, as Dr. Harper stated, while COCs do increase one's risk for venous thromboembolism, the risk of venous thromboembolism during pregnancy and the postpartum period is much higher than during the use of any COCs.